Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some interesting articles from the October 2021 issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Rodeo on your screens. The Cowboy Channel remains dedicated to the West's historic sport and to the cowboys and cowgirls making waves in the arena. By CNI Editors. In its 4-year run as a network, the Cowboy Channel has scored major points with rodeo fans by covering the marquee arena performances and by putting viewers up close for the biggest show, Wrangler National Finals Rodeo, each December. But it's not only the large-scale events that have made the network popular around the world. It's also the dedication and attention to smaller rodeos, the moments that define the year-long run-up to Vegas's flashing lights and gold buckles. Check in with the cable network or its Cowboy Channel Plus streaming platform on any given day, and you'll see the layers of the rodeo world peeled back. Apart from consistent live coverage on par with networks devoted to any other single sport, you'll find behind-the-scenes looks at the lives of the rodeo athletes and Western lifestyle personalities. The Cowboy Channel is doing its own version of world building for anyone who might not be able to attend rodeos every weekend. And for those who are, especially the athletes who give everything to the sport, it's a high-profile platform on which fans and loved ones can connect with their stories. Just in case you're not already hip to the network, Chief Executive Officer Raquel Gotch Kohler makes a solid case. If you love rodeo, you need to be watching the Cowboy Channel. But at the same time, if you simply like that rodeo that you go to once a year in your local community, tune in. You can become a fan of a wonderful sport, one that's patriotic and very friendly oriented. Here's more from Raquel, who's gearing up just like everyone else in her world for the NFR's return to Vegas. We're very honored to be the official network of Pro Rodeo and the official media partner of the PRCA. For us, we're just excited to build upon what we were able to do this year and last year, where we were able to show what an entire television network dedicated to pro rodeo really can do, especially around the NFR. And this December, we're thrilled to be returning to Vegas. We'll start every day live from the Cowboy Channel's Cowboy Christmas Ariat stage with Outside the Barrel, which will roll into a 2.5-hour NFR tailgate party. Next, we'll do our daily Western Sports Roundup, live from outside Thomas & Mack. Then, the inside NFR pre-show for 45 minutes into the start time of the regular NFR, followed by an hour NFR post-show. And finally, we'll end every night broadcasting live from South Point Casino, the Gold Buckle presentation. That's 10-plus hours of daily live broadcasting all 10 days and nights of the 2021 National Finals Rodeo. And the fun part? Every single one of these television shows has a live audience. Nothing is closed off from the public. So we invite fans to come out and be on television live from Las Vegas during the NFR. People come up to us all the time saying they've always liked rodeo, liked the sport, but it's been hard to be a fan of rodeo, never being able to follow rodeo like you are nowadays. Before, you just saw these cowboys and cowgirls on television during the 10 rounds at the NFR for maybe 8-second rides. But now you really get to know them, get to know their personality and see what their entire season looks like. The story we get to tell of these athletes is what we absolutely love doing. There's never been a roadmap for this. We just make it up as we go. What we thought originally, that people would love to see more rodeo in primetime every single night on a national television network, is working. We're just going to continue to build upon that. We're looking forward to keeping the momentum rolling from the NFR right into the Texas rodeos. We'll start with Denver, but then we'll go to Fort Worth and San Antonio and Houston, Rodeo Austin and San Angelo. So, we're hoping the energy will keep on going from NFR to the Texas rodeos to the 100 rodeos in 100 days. Unfortunately, a lot of these winter rodeos this year in 2021 had to cancel because of COVID. But we're looking forward to these bigger ones returning and showing them our support, while also showcasing these major rodeos to a television audience that continues to grow each week. We're quickly figuring out what works. Our goal is to add a lot more Western sports programming. You'll see more reining, more cutting, hopefully more quarter horse racing. Those are some areas that we would like to expand on. But you'll also see more Western lifestyle programming, from cooking shows and more fashion shows to you name it, all the areas that are important to the lifestyle in general. Rodeo will always be an anchor to the Cowboy Channel, but we want to be much more than just rodeo. Visit thecowboychannel.com to find out which TV providers carry the network. Explore the options for streaming it live online or on a smart TV device, as well as special subscription options for complete NFR access at cowboychannelplus.com. Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some interesting articles from the November-December issue of Cowboys and Indians. Let the Season Rip by Hunter Hawk. We're entering the season of family get-togethers and reunions with old friends, the return of classic recipes, and the recounting of stories from holidays past. We'll decorate our homes cheerily and add extra creature comforts to our entertaining spaces, whether they're glorious great rooms or cozy screened-in porches. We'll trim the tree and light the lights. We'll sing all the old familiar carols and play all those holiday records. We'll hold the highest hopes for the little bundles of joy on the way, and we'll cry especially sorrowful tears for the beautiful souls no longer with us. Some of us will have early snow. Others will wonder why the heck it feels like spring on Christmas Day. Some of us will walk with an extra lift in our steps. Others will struggle to get out of bed in the morning. The holidays can bring lots of highs and low lows. They're complicated beyond belief. I'll be the first to say that I'm no picnic during the holiday season. Already possessing the urge to hibernate and hide from the crowds during every other part of the year, I struggle with alternating feelings of gratitude and sadness as the year draws to a close. So, like a lot of people, I embrace worthwhile distractions and escapes from anything too heavy, not to avoid, but to redirect. One of my most enjoyable holiday kickoffs ever, when I resisted the urge to be solitary and instead threw myself into the action, was an unforgettable trip to NFR. For many of our readers and staff members, it's not the beginning of the holidays without that gathering of the great rodeo family that is December's Wrangler National Finals Rodeo. Returning this year to its longtime Las Vegas home, NFR injects the holiday season with travel, adventure, and, of course, primo shopping. You'll find CNI well represented as the lights go up on the championship rodeo and all it entails. We'll be smack dab in the middle of Cowboy Christmas, and we'll be partying nightly with live music and rodeo feeds at the Silverton. If you're a fellow holiday escapist, come and see us in Vegas. If you're sticking closer to home and need a good distraction, look no further than the TV family that's perhaps more complicated and more rife with conflict than any of our own. The Duttons of Paramount Network's Yellowstone. The long-awaited, and we mean long, fourth season hits screens in early November. We've been so anxious to know what happens after the many cliffhangers of season three that we've been Googling compulsively for updates. Like all fans of the show, we've been pining for the drama, Beth's wickedly funny clapbacks, and Rip Wheeler in general. Now that the wait is over, it's apropos that we've put Rip himself, actor Cole Hauser, on this edition's cover. As a character, there might be no better representation of the light and the darkness within all of us. He can be loving, angry, sad, and savage. That may be why we're so drawn to him and his fellow characters. They're as varied and contradictory and messy as any family you'll encounter this holiday season. And we're so glad to see them again. However you're handling the drama of the season, happy holidays to you. Be well and be merry. Spruce up the season. When it comes to holiday decorating and entertaining, these interior designers know a thing or two about making spirits bright. By Rhonda Reinhart. Denise Magaha. Denise Magaha Interiors, Dallas, Texas. What's your favorite holiday tradition and why? I love driving the streets of Dallas looking at Christmas lights. The homes in the park cities have some of the most elaborate holiday decorations, and everyone has their windows open wide to share their interior decorating and trees as well. What are your must-haves for holiday entertaining? Freshly pressed table linens. Fresh flowers and greenery both on the table and on the mantle, and non-alcoholic options for younger children and those who don't drink. They should also feel like they can partake in the festive mood. What's your favorite tree trimming tip? Buy 10 times the lights you think you need. You will always have strands that don't work for some reason, or you didn't calculate the number of strands needed. Nothing is worse than having to go back to purchase more and finding out they're out of lights and light temperature you need. What's your go-to trick for outside-the-box holiday decorating? I like to buy boxwood wreaths and allow them to dry after the holiday season. I've used them for several years in a row, and after they dry, I paint them gold and silver and continue to use them on my dining table as part of a centerpiece for spring holidays or reuse them the following year in my holiday decor. Do you have any other holiday advice or customs you'd like to share? Always provide a breakfast bread or muffin to send away with guests as their parting gift. If they arrive home after dining with you and need a little something sweet or want to savor the night before with a cup of coffee the next morning, this is the most favorite way to carry the festive feeling into the next day. DeniseMagaha.com. Courtney St. John. Courtney St. John Studio, Vail, Colorado. What's your favorite holiday tradition and why? A favorite holiday tradition for our family is the build-up to and anticipation of our annual Christmas Eve dinner, which typically includes an amazing fondue with as much extended family as we can gather. The special table setting we only use once a year provides that sense of tradition and cues the big celebration to come, and all the last-minute decorating and gift wrapping create that wonderful Christmas Eve energy. What are your must-haves for holiday entertaining? As an interior designer, the key must-have for holiday entertaining is a fun, festive, almost overly decorated house. If there was ever a time to go overboard, the holidays are it. In addition to obvious additions like a huge, lavishly decorated tree and stockings at the fireplace, we love to set up a Christmas village right at our entryway so guests enter into the spirit, enjoying it as they walk in. With all aspects of holiday decor, we find the enjoyment outweighs the effort. What's your favorite tree trimming tip? A favorite tip is to stay with a theme. I absolutely love vintage glass ornaments, and we have a fun collection we use every year. If you love using something that is special to you throughout the house, make sure it's incorporated into your tree. More is usually merrier in this case. Try plaids. Go a little crazy with color. Take cues from Mother Nature. Keep in mind, you get to add to it all the next year. What's your go-to trick for outside-the-box holiday decorating? If you have a special collection of things, whether it's Christmas-specific or not, it's a great opportunity to showcase it. We have a client who has an unbelievable collection of nutcrackers, for instance, and they are specially displayed and used every year with amazing results. Do you have any other holiday advice or customs you'd like to share? We, as a family, commit to getting our Christmas tree the day after Thanksgiving so we can enjoy it for as long as possible. CourtneyStJohnStudio.com. Emily Janik. Emily Janik Interiors, Jackson Hole, Wyoming. What's your favorite holiday tradition and why? Growing up, my aunt would give us a place setting of classic Spode Christmas china each year. When we were little, we admittedly weren't that thrilled to get the same gift every holiday. Now we are so thankful to have a full set of Christmas china for our holiday tables. My sister and I have continued the tradition for our own children. We get the boys silver julep cups, and the girls get a place setting of Gmunder Keramix Green Deer. We hope they'll appreciate that collection as much as we do. What are your must-haves for holiday entertaining? My husband and I really enjoy entertaining, so we love to pack our small home with guests around the holidays. I'm so glad I bought a beautifully leather-bound journal called Christmas Memories from Biscuit Home a few years ago. I've been good about recounting the late nights spent around the fireplace in that journal. I look forward to reading and thumbing through special Christmas cards I save and keep as bookmarks in the journal each year. What's your favorite tree trimming tip? On special occasions, I keep the champagne cork and make a note of the date of a birth, anniversary, etc. I make ornaments out of the corks for the tree. What's your go-to trick for outside-the-box holiday decorating? Not everything has to be red and green at Christmas. I'm all for using a beautiful textile like a vintage Suzani as my tablecloth. It adds some personality, and I love that it might not be totally expected. I also find that mixing citrus in with my florals and garland adds to the palette and will generally last longer than flowers. Do you have any other holiday advice or customs you'd like to share? Personalized gift tags are a must for me around the holidays. It's so easy to grab a bottle of wine and add your tag with a festive velvet ribbon on your way out the door to a holiday party. EmilyJanak.com.
Hello, this is Michael. I'll be reading articles from the November 2021 edition of True West Magazine. All hail the cowboy hat. from the boss of the planes to the Gus. In 1989, veteran actors Robert Duvall and Tommy Lee Jones co-starred in the epic CBS Western miniseries Lonesome Dove. Adapted from Larry McMurtry's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, the production featured Duvall and Jones playing best friends, two former Texas Rangers determined to drive a herd of cattle from the Rio Grande to Montana. Their characters, Captain Augustus Gus McCrae and Captain Woodrow F. Call, captured the imaginations of millions across the globe, and Lonesome Dove became a sensation and inspired a renewed interest in the Old West, including the iconic Western symbol invented by John B. Stetson, the cowboy hat. Lonesome Dove's producer, the late Bill Whitliff, turned to his hatmaker friend Manny Gummidge of Texas Hatters to make hats for Jones and Duvall. Jones wore a classic black boss of the plane style hat, nicknamed the Captain Call, customized with a taller crown and a dip in the front and the back, while Duvall sported a high-crowned Montana crease cowboy hat, nicknamed the Gus, a hat that Gummidge is credited with designing for the award-winning actor. Gummidge also created custom hats for Lonesome Dove co-stars Angelica Houston and the late Robert Urich. Without a doubt, the custom hat work and attention to historic details added authenticity that led to a renaissance in classic cowboy hat making across the United States. As Linda Sanchez notes in her feature on John B. Stetson and the origin of the cowboy hat, the legend of the Stetson goes beyond chivalry and the history of the Old West. Fortunately for us in 2021, the legend of the cowboy hat is not only alive and well, but has been documented by its proud owners for more than 150 years as an icon of America. In honor of the cowboy hat, the editors of True West take a look back at its highs and lows, from the boss of the plains to the Gus, and celebrate the hat and the hat makers, still winning the hearts and minds of wearers around the world. Big hats, big ranches, big stars. In 1865, John B. Stetson's hat factory in Philadelphia began making and shipping hats to all corners of the country. At the height of Stetson's success, his factory was making over 3.3 million hats a year. As the cowboy hat grew in popularity across North America in the 19th and early 20th century, hat makers began opening felt and straw hat factories and shops across the West for eager customers. Quickly, the number of styles and shapes of cowboy hats exploded and changed, reflected by the rugged individualism of the cowboys themselves. The working men of the Western ranges needed hats that could endure the harsh conditions of their work, and soon, tall crowns and wide brims grew out of necessity to help shade, cool, and warm the wearer of the hat. The Mexican sombrero with its tall sugarloaf crown influenced hat makers and wearers across the West, as did the more conservative bowler and fedora styles of the East. Cowboys shaped their hats to fit their personalities and considered their hats among their most valuable and treasured possessions in their daily life and work. In the late 19th and early 20th century, famous cowboy hat wearers, including Buffalo Bill Cody, Pawnee Bill, Annie Oakley, and Theodore Roosevelt, spread the popularity of the cowboy hat around the world. In the Roaring Twenties, with the rise of Western movies, radio shows, dime novels, dude ranches, and Western tourism, the cowboy hat and Western wear became a fixture in American fashion. Early movie stars Tom Mix, William S. Hart, Bob Steele, Hoot Gibson, and Hopalong Cassidy wore tall crowned hats, a style that remained popular among working cowboys too through the 1940s. But after World War II, the cowboy hat suddenly changed with the return of millions of veterans and the influence of the fedora, resulting in a shortened crown and brim. Cowboy heroes, rodeo stars, and buckaroos. In the 1950s and early 1960s, the cowboy was everywhere in America. From ranches to rodeos, From television to drive-in movie theaters, the cowboy was king. But the hat almost universally had transformed from the tall, high-crowned style worn for decades to a shorter, trimmer style. Presidents Truman and Johnson wore Stetson's Open Road, a short-crowned, short-brimmed hat, while movie and TV stars Randolph Scott, Glenn Ford, Steve McQueen, and Michael Landon wore smaller hats than their predecessors. Typically, sidekicks and comics would be the only ones sporting high-crowned cowboy hats on screen, while out west on ranches and farms in the 1950s, the style definitely reflected a more conservative era in hats. After President John F. Kennedy's decision to go hatless at his 1961 January inauguration, men's fashion across the U.S. followed suit, and men's hats and hat sales have never been the same. From the 1960s to the present, cowboy hat styles, shapes, and sizes have been dictated much more by the men and women who wear them for work and sport, giving way to distinct regional styles across the West. In popular culture, the cowboy hat remains an iconic symbol of the West, from the movies and television, country, Western, and country rock music, to rodeo, and even the Olympics, where more than once the cowboy hat was the official hat of the American and Canadian teams. Now today, fashion has embraced, re-embraced hats as a daily accessory for men and women, spurring a rise of hat shops and custom cowboy hat makers across the West. Own a piece of history and make it your own. From the first John B. Stetson Boss of the Plains in 1869 to the artisan-shaped, handmade custom cowboy hat of 2021, one fact has held true. Every proud owner of a new cowboy hat makes it their own. They shape it, dent it, add a hat band, a ribbon, a stampede string, even a pin or a feather. Many personalized hats are considered a wearer's most valuable possession, reflecting his or her own distinctive style. Whether a high or short crown, large or small brim, beaver or straw, buckaroo or rancher, cattleman or gambler, full taco or pencil roll, open crown or pinch front, hat makers across the West are ready to make your custom hat to fit your style, budget, work, and fashion. The following list represents just a sampling of Western hat makers in the business of making cowboy hat dreams come true. We recommend you check them out online and in person. Call and make an appointment today to have the custom hat you've wanted for years made today. You won't regret it, and soon you will be wearing your own one-of-a-kind piece of history. R&H Hat Co. Incorporated, Garland, Texas, phone 972-494-0511, online hat-co.com. American Hat Company, Bowie, Texas, 800-392-4197, americanhat.net. Bailey Hats Company, Fort Worth, Texas, 855-384-7018, baileyhats.com. Jackson Built Hat Company, International, Salmon, Idaho, 208-756-6444. Jackson Built Hats, JAXONBILT Hats. The Last Drop from His Stetson by Linda A. Sanchez. Mi buen compañero. Beba agua, mi buen compañero. Agua fresca del cielo. Beba para acariciar la sed. Beba mi caballo alazán lucero. De esta copa mi sombrero. Porque ya terminamos con el trabajo del día. Yo y mi caballo que se llama Bandolero. J. James Sanchez. Translated. Drink water, my good companion, fresh water coming from the heavens. Drink to satisfy your thirst. Drink my shining sorrel. From this cup, my sombrero, because we have finished with the work for the day. Myself and my horse, whose name is Bandolero. The legend of the Stetson goes beyond chivalry and the history of the Old West. It envelops those of us who loved the Western tradition and those who were born to it as the vaquero, cavalry officer, or cowboy and rancher. Stetsons represent more than 150 years of folklore, imagination, creativity, and courage. Perhaps nothing embodies this more than the painting by Southwestern artist Lon McGargy. Titled The Last Drop from His Stetson, it has become an icon, as has the hat itself, illustrating the respect and admiration the cowboy hat has for his selfless companion and partner, his horse. This painting is not only colorful, but depicts a Western scenario emblazoned on our collective memory, reminding us about our own unique heritage, that code of the West we all admire and try to live by. Cowboys might not want you to know about their great affection for a mere horse, but in this painting, one can see it, feel it, smell it, and taste it. McGargy captured and immortalized this image. The Stetson Hat Company management was smart enough to get it, and thus purchased the painting for advertising purposes. Little did they, or the artist, realize at the time how much a part of the American West that image would become. It still graces the inside of the Stetson. Western imagery, such as From His Stetson to His Boots, or He Swept Off His Stetson in a Gallant Gesture of Bravado, or numerous other images come to mind. By the way a crease was made in those days, one could tell from whence came the man. There were sweat-soaked working Stetsons, or Stetsons just simply meaning the cowboy hat. John Wayne wore them, as did Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, George Bush, Franklin Roosevelt, Herbert Hoover, and Ronald Reagan. Buffalo Bill Cody, Tom Mix, cavalry officers, the men of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and many others found them to be durable, practical in providing shade for the face from the unrelenting sun, a shield from wind and rain, and a way to carry water or to provide one's horse with a needed drink. The working cowboy always fed and watered his horse first. A good rubdown was often given, too, as a special reward for a hard day's labor. Thus, the act of offering water in his own hat that sheltered the cowboy from wind, rain, and sun was the best tribute to indicate respect, admiration, and yes, even affection for a mere beast. Whether riding fence, chasing errant calves or wild steers through brush, mesquite, or chola, or simply bringing the herd into another pasture, working with your horse was a spontaneous relationship marked by training and pride. That same horse, given enough rest, would carry the cowboy into the roping arena. Calf roping, bulldogging, and team roping encompass man's best relationship with a trained animal. Sometimes even getting down and personal when the team won or failed, it was still done as a team. And part of the team look was, of course, the man, his saddle, and his Stetson. Stetsons in particular are known for their style and class, but the word has come to mean, in general, the cowboy hat, even though today there are many good brands of Western headgear. But where did the Stetson tradition begin? John B. Stetson, 1830 to 1906, was born into a hat-making family in Orange, New Jersey. However, there was not enough room or profit for his entire family to make a living, so he decided to head out west. Additionally, his health was not the best, and he figured a change might not be a bad idea. He wanted to enlist in the military, but his health prevented that too. So, his next move was to join a group of rough miners on their way to the Colorado gold fields. That didn't last long, but while in the field, weather was miserable and everyone was suffering from the elements. Because of his hat-making background, Stetson fashioned out of beaver fur a fine felt cloth that was waterproof and had a big brim for protection. It also had a high crown and waterproof lining. He called the first hat the Boss of the Plains. It became so popular that Stetson returned to hat making, and by 1886, the Stetson Company was the largest in the world. He had also mechanized the hat making industry. Because of his time on the plains and in ranch country, Stetson had seen what was required, and because of that first-hand experience, he knew what men wanted. Another version says that the style really came from Christie's Hat Company in Frampton Cotterell, England. Even though Stetson's design was adapted for the plains and mountains of the United States, the owners of the UK factory were so committed to their belief that he had stolen their style that a lawsuit ensued. Stetson lost. However, as a hat maker, he would have had knowledge of different styles and purposes for hats. His adapting it to the way of the West is really what is important, and the rest is history, because the Stetson tradition continues, and Christie's is no longer even remembered in this struggle. The original Christie's factory today is a private residence. Eventually, the Stetson Company did go out of business in 1971, and the name was licensed out to other hat companies. From the 1800s to 1971 had been a mighty good run, and the name today conjures up image of the American West like no other. It does not really matter who designed the first prototype. We just know a Stetson when we see one. In 1912, when both New Mexico and Arizona became states, Margagee was commissioned to paint the history of this transition in Phoenix. At about the same time, he also painted the last drop from his Stetson. The Stetson Hat Company purchased the painting and rights in 1923, after it was first published on the cover of Western Story magazine. Lawn did not get much for the painting, and he was almost always broke. Lincoln County's own Eve Ball had crossed paths with Lawn before she moved to Ruidoso. Having purchased his guest ranch, La Casa Hermosa, outside Phoenix, she became acquainted with and enhanced by this crazy cowboy artist. For a while, he continued to live at La Casa, entertaining her many guests with his stories of adventures in Mexico and the Southwest. Once he was captured by the soldados, soldiers, of Pancho Villa. He lived dangerously and never had any dinero, so the only way he stayed alive was supposedly by entertaining the men with caricatures of themselves. Eventually, they let him escape. According to Eve, she had learned that he traveled extensively and lived in Spain for a year. That time enhanced his interest in unpretentious structures because he loved the honest simplicity of the Spanish and Mexican homes and the manner in which they utilized the materials about them. Learning from Lawn, Eve incorporated many of these same features in her own home in Ruidoso. The 5 acres of land Lawn purchased near the Arizona Biltmore in Phoenix soon became his comfortable Casa Hermosa, beautiful house, and Eve fondly described the huge hand-hewn beams that Lawn had salvaged from an abandoned mine. The corner fireplaces were constructed with deep window seats, an interior patio and gardens, as well as ironwork of exquisite simplicity, also incorporated into the home. Lon's zest for life seemed to get him through the hard times. He was married to at least 7 or 8 women. The ladies could not resist his charm or roguish smile. He was restless, independent, and totally irresponsible. However, he was talented as hell, and until he died in 1960, Lon McGargy was one of the most colorful of our Southwestern artists, a real character never to be replaced. And yes, he wore many a Stetson. Contributing editor Linda Sanchez and her husband James live along the beautiful Rio Bonito in historic Lincoln, New Mexico. They raise corriente, roping cattle, and you can bet they have worn many a Stetson too. Fight for Freedom by Candy Moulton. Follow the Northern Cheyenne's desperate and deadly dash for home from Oklahoma to Montana. The hot August 1878 weather bore down at Darlington Agency near Fort Reno in central Indian Territory. Northern Cheyenne leader Dull Knife and his followers had been harassed and pushed around since the attack on their camp on November 25, 1876. After being removed to Indian Territory and Darlington, they faced limits on hunting. There were few buffaloes, and a shortage of rations provided by the federal government meant many were hungry. The area was a hellhole. Hot, sultry air combined with disease and starvation to decimate the Indians. By September 1878, fewer than 350 had survived. In addition to Dull Knife, Little Wolf, Old Crow, and Wild Hog were leaders of these Northern Cheyennes. They did what they could to improve conditions for the people, but discontent grew, and by early September, the tribal members had abandoned their camps at Darlington. They were going home, back to tribal ranges in South Dakota, Wyoming, and Montana territories. Their 750-mile, 44-day trek took them across western Oklahoma, Kansas, and Nebraska. Along the way, they engaged in attacks and raids on settlers as federal troops quickly amassed and set off in pursuit. By the time the soldiers reached the Cimarron River, not far from the present town of Freedom, Oklahoma, the Indian women and families were far ahead, but many of the Indian men remained in the region, watching the soldiers as they came after the tribe. The Cheyenne men finally faced off with the pursuing 4th Cavalry and a number of Indian scouts, many of whom were also Cheyennes. When the scouts told Little Wolf and the people with him to go back to Indian Territory, Curly Hair, one of the men with Little Wolf, said, "Go back and tell them we are going home. We don't want any fighting. If the army wants to fight us, they can. We are not going back." The melee that followed started when an Arapaho scout with the soldiers noticed one of his horses being ridden by a Northern Cheyenne man. He took a pistol from a soldier and raced toward the Cheyenne tribesmen. This led to the Battle of Turkey Springs on September 13th and 14th, and the killing of 20 soldiers, plus the wounding or killing of many horses. The Northern Cheyennes left the battlefield victorious. Following their families, they rode north across western Kansas. Some troops had organized at Sidney Barracks in Nebraska shortly after the Indian breakout. Located on the Union Pacific Railroad line, Sidney Barracks had access to trains that could carry soldiers east or west to intercept the Cheyennes, should they make it that far north. Major Thomas Tipton Thornburg of the 14th Infantry responded, but failed to stop the Cheyennes who crossed the railroad just east of Ogallala, Nebraska, and then disappeared into the Sandhills. Now back in Nebraska, but with troops closing in from various directions, the Indians split their ranks. Little Wolf and his band headed toward the Powder River and eventually reached Montana Territory. Dull Knife, Wild Hog, Old Crow, and their followers turned toward the old Red Cloud Agency near Camp Robinson, expecting to find sanctuary with Red Cloud and other Lakotas. They did not know that the agency had been moved and was now situated along the Missouri River. Troops with Major Caleb H. Carlton's 3rd Cavalry, based at Camp Robinson, set out looking for the fleeing Indians, and in a foggy accident on October 25th, stumbled onto the camp of Dull Knife and Wild Hog. Following tense negotiations, the Indians were taken into custody and moved to Camp Robinson, where they were held in an abandoned barracks. Sergeant Carter P. Johnson was with the troops and later told Indian Wars historian Walter Camp that Dull Knife said his people were hungry and if we would give them something to eat, they would follow. We set out some rations and the Indians took them and followed us. This was at about 10 a.m. We went down into the valley and camped that night on Chadron Creek. Dull Knife's band camped in the creek bottom, and we had only two companies at that time camped on both banks right over them. Buffalo Hump was with Dull Knife and also later told camp about the Cheyenne surrender. When Dull Knife surrendered, there was no firing on the part of either soldiers or Indians. When they surrendered, most of them gave up their arms, but a few concealed them under their clothing and in this way retained possession. In December 1878, Camp Robinson was renamed Fort Robinson, and by January 3rd, 1879, the Cheyennes were crammed into a log barracks at the post. In the early days of the Indians' incarceration, the soldiers prepared food for them. The women and children were allowed to go outside the barracks freely, and the men were permitted to be outside with supervision. The Indians were pleasant and agreeable to their guards inside and often talked and smoked with us in the little room. They all had their dogs with them in the barracks and a heating stove and were comfortable enough, Johnson said. The atmosphere changed when orders came to once again remove the Cheyennes to Indian territory. The tribe's people made it clear that they would die first. When negotiations with the headmen failed, Captain Henry W. Wessels removed leaders Wild Hog and Old Crow from the barracks and cut off food, water, and fuel supplies to the remaining people inside. Lacking basic supplies, the Indians now became very ugly to the inside guards, having changed their demeanor completely and were getting to be very unruly, Johnson said. The troops were on heightened alert while the Indians reportedly sang and danced, tore up the floorboards, and barricaded the windows. After dark, on January 9, 1879, the Cheyennes were quiet, according to Sergeant Johnson, who said, "I declared then and there that they were getting ready to come out." Upon hearing the first gunshot later that evening, the sergeant ordered his men toward the fort. "We double-quicked to the fort, over a mile away, not waiting even to fully dress." Buffalo Hump recalled, "When it became evident that the soldiers intended to starve us to death, we thought we might as well die fighting as to starve, so it was decided to break out." He described the action. The soldiers had boarded up their windows of the guardhouse and built a fence around the house a little way from it, and the guards were patrolling outside the fence. "When the time came to break out, I busted the boards from the window and was first out and knocked a hole through the fence with an axe. A fight started right there." Once outside the barracks, Buffalo Hump joined his mother and sister, Dull Knife, and other members of the band. "We were out 10 days without anything to eat, and we nearly perished," he recalled. Eventually, some of the 149 Northern Cheyennes who had escaped found refuge with the Lakotas at Pine Ridge. More than 30 Indians were killed and another 30 were wounded during the escape from Fort Robinson. 11 members of the 3rd Cavalry died and 10 were wounded. The outbreak from Fort Robinson is recognized every year with the Fort Robinson Outbreak Spiritual 400-mile run for young people who leave the barracks where their ancestors were imprisoned on the actual day and time that the outbreak happened in 1879, January 9th, 10:30 p.m. They run from Fort Robinson north through the Black Hills into Montana and across the Northern Cheyenne Reservation along Highway 212, which is designated the Warriors Trail for the number of historical sites in the area. The runners end their ceremonial trek at a hilltop burial ground in Busby, Montana, where more than 24 men, women, and children killed during the outbreak are buried. First started to honor ancestors, now the run centers on healing and wellness, cultural and language preservation, and other social issues important to the Northern Cheyenne people. Cave Creek, Arizona, by Peter Corbett. Scottsdale, which has gotten too big for its britches, has long proclaimed itself the West's most western town. But truth be known, it's not even the most western town in Maricopa County, Arizona. that title would fairly go to Feisty Cave Creek on Scottsdale's northern flank. The town, settled by miners and ranchers 150 years ago, tried to wrest away Scottsdale's delusionary motto 8 years ago, but the big city boys lawyered up and shut them down. So Cave Creek, just shy of 6,000 souls, settled on Where the West Lives. See for yourself. The Western spirit is alive at the Buffalo Chip Saloon, with bull riding for big belt buckle cowboys and greenhorns fueled by bravado. It lives each spring for Cave Creek Rodeo Days. It's there at the Hideaway, the place to be seen on your Harley, Old Indian, or Custom Bagger. Find that spirit on a trail ride at Spur Cross Ranch with Arizona Horseback Adventure. Take a hike there or up Black Mountain. While Cave Creek still has open range, suburban development in Scottsdale and Phoenix is not far from the town's rustic core. But the Creekers, as they call themselves, have dug in their boot heels to preserve Cave Creek's Western heritage, according to locals like Evelyn Johnson, Cave Creek Museum interim director. "We're holding on to it as tight as we can," Johnson said. "Civilization, I'm going to call it, creeps further in. It's harder and harder to keep that Western flair." Cave Creek Museum is holding on to the town's history with its collection of art and artifacts. Cave Creek got its start 150 years ago as a cavalry remount station on the road between nearby Fort McDowell and Fort Whipple in Prescott. The museum features a very large relic of Cave Creek's mining era, a 10-stamp mill used to crush ore at the Golden Reef Mine, 5 miles north of town. The restored 84,000-pound mill is powered up for demonstrations on the second Saturday of each month, October to May. Over the past 6 decades, Cave Creek has attracted artists drawn to the desert and quieter lifestyle. The late John W. Hampton had a Cave Creek studio in 1965 when he and three other Western artists founded the Cowboy Artists of America in Sedona. One of Cave Creek's signature art events is the Sonoran Art League's Hidden in the Hills studio tour in late November. Music is also a big draw for Cave Creek. "There's live music about every night," said Kelly Francis, a town spokeswoman. "You can find it at a corner shop or one of the bigger bars like Harold's or The Chip." Other venues include the Mountain View Pub and Janie's Coffee House, which features acoustic music and craft beers on its desert patio. The town recently embarked on a program to recognize its landmarks with bronze plaques, the first being Harold's Cave Creek Corral, the big spread bar-restaurant that started serving drinks in 1935 to thirsty dam builders working on Bartlett Dam. Next was Big Earl's Greasy Eats, a hamburger joint and an 85-year-old filling station. The Buffalo Chip and the Hideaway are on the landmarks list. The Chip started as a one-room bar in 1951 and expanded over the decades before fire destroyed it on Thanksgiving Day 6 years ago. Rebuilt from the ashes, it still has a bandstand and an outdoor arena for bullfighting. The Hideaway slogan proclaims, "There are no strangers here, just friends you haven't met." Its history includes serving as housing for dam workers, a chocolate shop 30 years ago, and a French bistro called the Thirsty Cactus. Another landmark was Carpenter's Trading Post. E.B. Carpenter, a lapidartist and silversmith, established the rock shop in 1951 and operated it for nearly 20 years, Francis said. It's now the Coyote Creek Shop, selling furniture, gifts, and garden art. All the landmarks fit into Cave Creek's heritage, which celebrates people from all walks of life and is all about a philosophy of live and let live, she said. Elderberries, not just for your health, by Sherry Monahan. Elderberries were popular on the frontier and were used in multiple ways. Both the snowy white flowers and deep dark berries were made into medicine, syrup, tea, jam, and jelly, pie, wine, brandy, and even ink. Some people didn't like them too much because they were too invasive. While technically a bush, they can grow 15 feet tall and were often called trees. The trees grew in abundance in Indian Valley, California, which troubled one person only identified as Columbine in the Feather River Bulletin. Columbine wrote that they grew everywhere and were not profitable fruit like peaches and apples. He wrote, "If nature has created anything we heartily dislike, it's that obtrusive, intruding elderberry. And then such fruit it bears, we would as soon eat wild ground cherries. It seems to us that this place was designed for the purpose of trying one's powers of endurance, living on nothing." Adding to the annoyance was the fact that the leaves and roots are toxic, as are the berries, unless they're cooked. The Evening Call lead in South Dakota ran a story with mixed emotions about them entitled "Exterminating Elder Bushes." The writer felt the only way to eradicate them was to completely destroy the roots. Samuel Milner noted that not all of the elderberry bushes should be destroyed, and a small patch should be kept and would be nice for family use, he reported. The blossoms dried make a medicinal tea, and the jelly of the fruit is an excellent relief for a cough. A teaspoon of it dissolved in a tumbler of hot water is a great relief when the throat is sore and there is hoarseness. I consider elderberry pie one of the best, and a wine made of elderberries is fine and by no means hard to take. In 1892, Kansas was considered to be a prohibition state, so when J.W. McKay wrote to the Kansas farmer asking for a recipe for wine, the newspaper stated as much. However, the article continued that it could be made for medicinal reasons, but of course, as a newspaper, it had no idea how to make wine. It noted that many cookbooks provided recipes, including Dr. Price's Table and Kitchen, but this was for currant wine. The Kansas farmer noted that the recipe included 1 quart of currant juice to 3 pounds of sugar, with sufficient water to make a gallon. For a paper that claimed to know nothing about winemaking, it included some very detailed information. Elderberries produce a thicker or heavier juice than currant, and 1/4 more water may be added. And being sweeter than currant, 1/4 less sugar will be needed. The juice, sugar, and water should be stirred thoroughly and put in a clean cask or jar in a moderately cool place. An ordinary cellar will do. After fermenting about 30 days, it should be carefully drawn off, bottled, and corked tightly. Put bottles on the cellar shelf, and after 4 or 5 months, only use in case of sickness. If you can't get elderberries near you, Northwest Wild Foods in Burlington, Washington, offers them, along with the health syrup and fruit spread. Historic Honeywood Winery in Salem, Oregon, sells elderberry wine only locally, but also ships elderberry and elderflower tea, tonics, oils, and vinegar. Recipe: Elderberry Cough Syrup. 1 cup elderberries, 1 1/4 cups water, 1 cup molasses, 4 tablespoons brandy. Wash and clean the berries, place everything in a saucepan, and gently boil for 20 minutes. Cool and place into a glass container and use as needed. Store in refrigerator to extend life and keep fresh. Recipe adapted from Kansas's The Eureka Herald, March 11, 1875, which noted, "This is an excellent remedy for a tight cough." Sherry Monahan has penned Mrs. Earp, Wives and Lovers of the Earp Brothers, California Vines, Wines and Pioneers, Taste of Tombstone, The Wicked West, and Tombstone's Treasure. She's appeared on the History Channel and Lost Worlds and other shows.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.